Hello, everybody, and welcome to Giant Mess, a super sloppy sports entertainment talk show that covers Giants football, Mets baseball, movies, and TV shows. It's got a little comedy and life lessons mixed in for good measure. It's hosted by a Giant Mess. That's me, the real cinch, Neil Lynch. I'm a former college quarterback and pitcher who's turned into quite the overthinker and one hell of a stinker. On today's episode, we're going to be reviewing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, Totally Killer, an R-rated slasher comedy time travel flick from Amazon Prime Video. So with that, let's get started up in here. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem. Animated feature. I think it came out in theaters right around the same time as Barbie and Oppenheimer. So July, I want to say. Follows the Turtle Brothers, as they work to earn the love of New York City while facing down an army of mutants. Directed by Jeff Rowe, co-wrote the screenplay with Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, Dan Hernandez, and Benji Samit. From a story he co-wrote with Brendan O'Brien, Seth Rogen, and Evan Goldberg. Jeff Rowe, not the guy from Dirty Jobs. Learned that the hard way. He wrote and directed Mitchells vs. the Machines, which I officially gave an 8 rating on IMDb. I think it was a 7.6 to be exact. From everyone else, I gave it an 8. And I gave this one an 8 as well. Rowe also wrote Disenchantment, which if you have Netflix, you've probably seen it. It kind of looks like the same animation style as The Simpsons and Futurama, if that helps. Haven't watched it, but it's something that maybe I would enjoy. Rowe cited the teenage features Stand By Me, Freaks and Geeks, The Edge of 17, Lady Bird, and Pen 15, which I've seen all those except Pen 15, but I've heard good things about Pen 15. He listed all those movies as an influence on the film, and Rogan once stated, you know, he was asked about his approach, how this one would be different from the others, which it is, I would say, significantly probably the most different in terms of, and it was all good in my opinion. Most of it was all good. So it was an August 2020 interview with Collider, and Seth Rogen said that the film would heavily lean into the teenage element of the Turtles, stating that as a lifelong fan of Ninja Turtles, weirdly the teenage part of their name, their moniker, was always the part that stuck out to me the most. And as someone who loves teenage movies, who's made a lot of teenage movies and who literally got their start in their entire profession by writing a teenage movie, the idea of kind of honing in on the element was really exciting to us. So, for instance, like the voice cast for these four characters are all actual teenagers. And I thought that was, it's genius, and it kind of makes you wonder, like, how did we overlook that in the past? But yeah, they're all teenagers. And I would say, like, all the voices are great. The one kid's voice is too high. I'm sorry. I know it's not his fault. I know puberty is probably bearing down on him coming down the pike, but the high voice just really threw me off. It was Donatello. So like, I love that they really made them all unique in their own way. Donatello was a little bit of a stretch for me. I was just like, I just can't, this is not clicking for me. But like, Leonardo looks different from Michelangelo, who looks different from Raphael, who looks different from Donatello. They all looked unique, like their own turtle. You know, Leonardo is not the biggest difference from this and the other franchises, the movies, the TV show, the cartoon, whatever. But Raphael is like bigger, the biggest of the crew, and has like rage problems. And doesn't wear the traditional bent, like eye mask where it's just covering the eyes and wraps around the head. He has like almost like a full head bandana, which I thought was an interesting take, and like just helped to make him stand out a little bit more on his own. And then Michelangelo was more on the smaller side. And what was interesting is now that I think about it, like they made Michelangelo his own. Did they? But I felt like it wasn't like the classic Michelangelo that we've seen in the movies and in the cartoon series. Like, not as like out there, cowabunga, like I'm the fun guy. I feel like they reined that in a little bit. Although they did say like he loves comedy and he likes to tell jokes and wants to do improv. I don't think that was too pervasive or prevalent in the movie throughout. I think they like kind of touched it out in the beginning, and then you never really got to see more of that down the line. didn't ultimately negatively impact the movie. It was just like, And then fucking Donatello, who's like the skinniest and scrawniest of the crew, and he has like glasses and the high-pitched voice. And I was just like, okay, yeah, I guess this does work. The high-pitched voice, though, kind of throws me off, you know? And it's because you think about the two movies. Like, I grew up, you know, when I was, I mean, it was like they were at the height of their fame, right? They launched the cartoon series in 87, 88. Watched that. Watched the live-action movies in 90 and 92. Or was it 88 and 90? watched those. And like in the cartoon series, they all look the same. They had different personalities, right? And they're doing their own things, but they all look the same. You could interchange the colors on their mask and you wouldn't know the difference, you know, just sight alone. And same with the movies, you know, one and two. It's like they're basically the same size and they all look super muscular and beefy, just like they do in the cartoon series where they look like friggin' bodybuilders, right? Just cut and yoked. And then you had the Michael Bay turtles where it was like they were just like fucking so huge and like looked nothing, but all looking that like the same size, but looking just like tanks, just monsters. And then this one, it was just, it's like refreshing and nice to see, oh, like this one looks different from this one, looks different from this one, looks different. Like you can tell them apart. They all have their own kind of unique traits and characteristics. So I really did appreciate that. I'm not going to comment on the April O'Neil character. She did a great job. In lore, it's a white chick, short red hair, very hot. Like, to the point where all the four turtles, all four brothers were like wanted in on the action there. Like, that's some serious interspecies hotness. This one, it was, she is a black woman. Black woman? I mean, I feel weird saying woman of color. Not, you can't say colored woman, but you can say woman of color. Got it. Woman of color, and on the voluptuous, like really curvy, like if she was on a dating app, I think she would say a little extra, or what is it, would say curvy, or more than a handful. What is it? It's not more than a handful. Yikes. Yeah, so she's heavier than your traditional April O'Neil, who was previously played by Megan friggin' Fox. you had Maya Rudolph as Cynthia Utram, who turns out to be a villain, I think. And we'll get into what she's based on. But not to say that I'm like this diehard turtle head. Like, I love the turtles. But I don't know all the comics and all the ins and outs and whatnot. I'm not familiar with Cynthia Utram. John Cena was voices Rocksteady. This is the thing about this voice cast. It's fucking stacked. You would never know it by watching this movie. I recognized two voices, Seth Rogen as Bebop and Ice Cube as Superfly. John Cena apparently was Rocksteady, which Rocksteady, I don't know if it was Rocksteady or Bebop, but one of them had the Rick Ross titties, you know? They're both big dudes, and he had the kind of the flapjacks that were pierced. I think it was Rocksteady. Maybe it was Bebop. I also didn't understand why Rocksteady and Bebop, like, the way, well, I guess we'll get to it. The rest of the cast, Rose Byrne as Leatherhead, Natasha Demetrio as Wingnut, Giancarlo Esposito as Baxter Stockman, the scientist who ends up creating this family of mutants. Jackie Chan as Splinter? No idea it was Jackie Chan. Paul Rudd as Mondo Gecko? No idea. Post Malone as Ray Filet? No idea. Hannibal Buress as Genghis Frog? No idea. You know, it's just a virtual who's who of voice cast, and I could not identify. I identified two. So, in the contrast to the norm for animation, the cast recorded their voice roles together in groups rather than independently from one another. A single recording session could include up to seven actors. This environment allowed for the cast to play off each other, as well as employ a lot of improvisation in the performances. Which, how is that not the standard practice? How is that not? And I get it. It's why a lot of animated features can take up to 2 years or 3 years or longer to make, is because they must have the most flexible schedules for actors, right? So they can just pop in, record their stuff, and pop out. They don't need to all be together at once. So I guess that makes sense. But I also feel like you lose that chemistry that we'd have when everyone's in the room. So I dig that they're able to get everyone in the room together like that, because I think it for sure made for a better dialogue and interaction. The filmmakers also cited Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the Jackie Chan film's Police Story, Rumble in the Bronx, Boogie Nights. Whoa. And the work of Spike Jones as influences for the visual style of the film. It is crazy that it felt like basically every animated film looked the same for so long. And then Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse comes along and is just like, check this shit out. You can actually do it a different way. And it's nice to see, you know, it's like Jeff Rowe wrote and directed Mitchell versus Machines. This has a somewhat similar look to that, almost like a comic book. It looks like it's actually a comic book in motion. The soundtrack for this friggin' movie was electric. One of the best soundtracks of all time. I mean, it has, I knew that, and I had a good feeling about this movie when one of the opening scenes is, the song is Annie Up by M.O.P. Are you fucking kidding me, dude? That was my jam. Senior year in college. Literally, I wanted to come out to that song as my walkout song for baseball, like when I'm coming out of the bullpen and, you know, I'm about to get shelled. Annie Up by M.O.P. Ended up not being able to use it because of the lyrics are pretty explicit. So when that came on, I was like, Annie Up is playing right now? Like, they're going to go with Annie Up? Whoa, dude. Smack That Fool? Annie Up? Kidnap That Fool? Run Your Jewels? What? They're playing that right now? So that was like an eye-opener. But then it's like, all of a sudden, Annie Up is in like commercials. It's just like, what? This song is about straight up robbing people, and it's it is everywhere right now. I mean, I love it, but it's also kind of a whoa. What a difference 2 decades makes. Scarface Pushed It to the Limit. Anytime you can throw that on the soundtrack, yes, more please. No Diggity by Blackstreet, fuck yeah. Wake Up in the Sky, which I've never heard before, but it's performed by Gucci Mane, Bruno Mars, and Kodak Black. Yes, yes, yes. Unwritten by Natasha Bedingfield. Shimmy Shimmy Yaw by ODB. I feel like that's like a must-have for any Seth Rogen movie. What's Up by 4 Non-Blondes. And The Icing on the Cake. Yes, Ninja Rap by Vanilla Ice. Now, it wasn't extensive. It wasn't a lot. It was just a nice little subtle nod to Secret of the Ooze when they are getting into their first fight, right? They're trying to track down April's scooter. They track it down to the like a garage, mechanics garage, where all the thugs and goons and bad guys are. And then that's when they get in their first fisticuffs, first fight, first combat. And at one point, I don't know who it was. It might've been Leonardo, climbs through the car, through the windows, you know, to get away from the guy. Ends up accidentally turning on the radio, and it's go ninja, go ninja, go, go ninja, go ninja, go. So, I mean, yes, thank you. Thank you for that little bit of fan service. And then Can I Kick It by Tribe Called Quest. I mean, like, dude, this is basically like my playlist every day. It's like before this even came out. So, like, it's good to know that I can just, I'll just favorite that TMNT soundtrack and get it going. So some of the themes that the film covered, ultimately, it's about a father, his 4 sons, and the importance of family, right? Acceptance, right? Because Splinter, when he was first turned into a human sized rat, would cave in and go to the surface because he had these 4 little baby turtles. And so he needed to get them, you know, something beyond what they were doing. And so he goes up in the middle of Times Square, which is like, hey, Splinter, newsflash, don't go to Times Square. Okay, guy. And that's when he's like, everyone's like, oh, my God, it's a giant rat. And so, like, you know, people booing and hissing and generally being very awful to this human sized rat, which reality bites, dude. Like, I feel like that would be the actual reaction. I know it's New York. I know a lot of people let a lot fly in that city. I've seen it. I've been a part of it. But like a human sized rat, no thanks. So Splinter ends up becoming this hermit And he tries to protect his four sons, right? The turtles, as they grow up. And he's like, you know, you can't, humans are not to be trusted. Humans are monsters. So it's a lot about, you know, not just them trying to get humans to accept them as mutants, but the mutants also accepting humans and saying that they're not all bad. Okay. We get, there's April O'Neil. She's good. So Jeff Rowe was asked if the film was written as an immigration fable, because there's a lot of corollaries, right? And he responded that that was not the initial intention, you know, but there are a lot of parallels between Splinter and a first generation parent who moved to the country. But they ultimately highlighted it throughout the execution. So I definitely picked up on that big time. So not going to go over the entire plot, but I will say this. Interesting direction that they went in. The fact that they, like, I think Superfly is a great villain. Like, spoiler, Shredder is not the main villain. It's this character named Superfly, who I vaguely recall from the cartoon series, possibly. You know, I figure you have enough episodes, you get to, like, feature, you know, a little more than a handful of characters. So I think Superfly was featured on that. And I think originally in the comics, it was the scientist who turns into Superfly. And in this rendition version, the scientist creates the Superfly, right? And it's not, he's not the Superfly. So we're introduced to like a shit ton of mutants. We're introduced to a ton of characters in this movie, which I almost kind of thought was a mistake. You would think, and maybe this is why I'm the idiot here, and like I'm wrong and they're right, and they most likely they are right and I am wrong. You're aiming for the trilogy, right? That's like the coup d'etat, the coup de grace, right? Like that's the big one. That's the big prize. You get the trilogy, you know, and so the expectation is three films. That's the hope. And so I'd think that you would really bring out all the guns in the last one, in the third one. Like you slowly introduce characters over the first one, introduce more characters in the second one, and then you have everyone's, like, it's a big old Royal Rumble in the third one. They just came out guns blazing the first one, and they introduced, like, almost the entire roster. It was like, oh my god, like, not only Rocksteady and Bebop, Wingnut, like we mentioned in the voice cast, like, there's just a ton of mutants that they went with. Which, you know, I guess, I don't know. Like the turtles try to work for Superfly to get the inside intel to like prevent the what have you, like this machine from going off, this machine that would turn all humans into the mutants. So they try to get into the crew, and that's when we first meet all the mutants. And so that's when the mutants are working for Superfly. But then eventually all the mutants turn against Superfly because the turtles convince them that they should. You know, humans aren't bad, and this is not right, and da da da. We need to respect our differences, right? Which is, you know, ongoing theme for this generation. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, like, yeah, you don't have to be different. Like, don't force yourself to be different. Like, just be different. Does that make sense? So yeah, they turn on Superfly. So it's you know, I know this is stupid criticism. It's not even criticism. It's just like, to me, Bebop and Rocksteady are villains. They are the bad guys. Like, they're the lovable bad guys. And I think a lot of people would like them to be good. But that's like the appeal of them is like they're the bad guys. You want to be good because they're so cool. So now they're just like good guys now. Like that's where I'm failing to recognize like where this is headed as a franchise. Because, like, I think it was wise that they didn't throw Shredder in there the first release. I get it. I guess he was part of the original script, and they ended up scrapping him, which I appreciate. I think that's the right move. Because, like, that's, like, the go-to villain, right? That's, like, the main big bad guy. Rocksteady and Bebop, what the fuck happened? It's like you see them, and they get, like, a decent intro. They didn't have many lines. And you're dealing with, like, 6 to 10 other friggin' mutants. Like, they didn't get their share of the spotlight, you know? So, a little disappointed in that. Ultimately, didn't, like, ruin my opinion of the movie. But I did think it was, I just thought it was interesting that they would go that route, you know? Introducing so many mutants. And now it's like, So for me, it's like, the spoiler, there's a scene in the closing credits where they end up showing this Cynthia Utrom spying on them, and she decides to call in the Shredder. And so you get to see the Shredder silhouette as he's looking over the, looking at the city. Very cool. So you can expect to see more Shredder in the second one. But what about all these, this heat? And all of a sudden, end of the movie, all this family of mutants, like all the bad guy mutants that turned and became good, are now living with friggin' Splinter and the Turtles. What the fuck? And like they're like there's one big family now, like Rocksteady and Bebop. That's it. They had like two scenes where they were like badass, and now they're fighting for good. Did that happen in the comics? Did that happen in the cartoon series? I just don't recall. But as far as the future goes, I didn't pick up on this, but I just read this on IMDb. During the scene where Splinter is giving the Turtles their backstory, a van drives by in the background with the head of an orange Triceratops on the side. The Triceratons were an alien race the Turtles went up against in the original comic series that appeared as humanoid Triceratops with orange skin and later appeared in several of the cartoon series, video games, and later comics. It was reported. So I think you're looking at maybe they're hinting and teasing at the fact that they'll be in the second one. That'd be kind of dope. Or maybe it was just a nice little fan service Easter egg. Could be that. But I almost would rather that happen than like what I don't like them teaming up with Shredder or Shredder. They got to fight on two fronts. They got the Shredder attack over here doing his own thing. And then you got the Triceratons arriving and throwing shit into a frenzy. I just like, so I guess it's now just like this 20 person team. It's like, all right, we got a whole fucking football squad here. Good to know. It is reported that a sequel and a two season animated TV series have been greenlit for Paramount Plus. And Jeff Rowe is set to return as the director, which I agree with. And Point Grey, which is Seth Rogen's production company, will produce both sequel in the series, which, yeah, I think you knocked it out of the park. Let's do it again. There weren't many quotes. This one I thought was funny. Raphael says, "Do we not have last names?" Donatello says, "Whoa, who are we?" So yeah, it's like they don't have last names. Like he just, as a kid, you just don't question that. It's like the fact that no one has ever brought that up ever is kind of wild. And you know, it's now existed for 30 plus years, and we're just now like someone's asking the hard questions. Interesting. Splinter's look was based on Danny DeVito and Jeff Bridges, specifically his performance as the dude in The Big Lebowski. I didn't really pick up on that, but I do, now that I think about it, I do kind of see it, you know. This is the first, so the color scheme of the outfit and the glasses that the character Cynthia Utrom wears matches that of the villain Krang. Her last name of Utrom, U-T-R-O-M, refers to the species that were first introduced in the original comics and earlier media, starting with the TMNT in 2003. Krang was based off of, and Krang would later be officially identified as one since the later comics. So interesting, because you do look at her and you're like, she don't look right. She doesn't look like a normal person, like a human being. And yeah, they had a lot of different characters with a lot of different shaped heads, but the shape she had going on, I was like, huh. So, and I didn't even think Krang when I looked at her, but now that you mentioned Krang, it's like, oh, that does kind of connect for me. So, and that's another guy we got waiting in the wings. So Shredder, Krang, the Triceratons. A lot to play with there. It's just like, I don't know, where do you go with this mutant family? Unless it's like Shredder is able to hypnotize them and get them to recruit them to his army. Like he's got some kind of, I don't know, potion. What do the critics think? Well, the critics' consensus on Rotten Tomatoes was with its unique visual style and a story that captures the essence of the franchise's appeal, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem is an animated treat for the whole family. 96% of all critics gave it a positive review with an average rating of 7.6 out of 10. And then 89% of top critics gave it a favorable review with an average rating of 7.3 out of 10. I gave it an 8, just like I did Mitchell's versus the Machines. I dug it a lot. There were like two or three little nitpicky things that I'm only nitpicking because I'm an old fuck. And we've now begun our transition into grumpy old man, who is too attached to nostalgia. the audience on Rotten Tomatoes says, with fantastic visuals and excellent voice cast and lots of laughs, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem might be the best film in the franchise. I'm going to say, yeah, it is the best film in the franchise. Although, you know, it's tough for me. That's tough for me to admit, because I think the little kid in me wants to say you cannot top the first one. And I'd go so far as to say that second one still hits, slaps, spanks, bangs, all the good verbs. But yeah, this is the best film in the franchise. It's actually the only film in the franchise with a positive score, with a positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Oh boy. 90% of the verified audience members on Rotten Tomatoes gave it a favorable review with an average rating of 4.4 out of 5. 84% of the top audience positively reviewed it with an average rating of 4.2 out of 5. So yeah, I would say I'm in between the critics and the fans. Shocking, I know. Metacritic assigned a film, assigned a score of 74 out of 100. Generally favorable reviews. Cinema Scores average grade was A. And those polled at Post-Track gave it an 88% overall positive score, with 70% saying they would definitely recommend the film. And I am part of that 70%, whether you are a parent or a kiddo. I think Bria was into it. My daughter was into it. But she did ask, how long is this? She's like, how much longer do we have? So I think it did run a little bit long for a five-year-old. But for me, it was just right. As of October 22nd, the movie grossed almost $119 million in the United States and Canada, almost $62 million in other territories. It finished fourth in its opening weekend behind Barbie, Meg 2, The Trench, and Oppenheimer. I mean, yeah, you ran up against a fucking buzzsaw. And who would have predicted that Barbie and Oppenheimer would just like crush as much as it did at the box, as much as they did at the box office? Meg 2 of the Trench is interesting. I'm just like, huh? Like I went and saw the Meg in the theaters because I had movie pass, and I was just like, this seems like this movie will pass for me. And so I think maybe Meg 2 of the Trench, like it developed maybe a cult following after How Did It Get Made, did an episode on it. I think people caught on, like this is supposed to be kind of corny, schlocky, campy. It's still surprising. Especially beating out, you know, this movie that I would think would have a lot more IP weight. Is that a thing? So, yeah, that's a recommend for me, dog. Cowabunga. It's going to be the thumbnail. Me just smiling with my thumbs up with cowabunga over my head. Yeah, so that looking forward to the next two. Hopefully I can go see it in the theater. Maybe I can convince her. You know, it took a lot of convincing. Doing a lot of convincing with my daughter in order for her to cave in and let me see it. So thank God I was able to win that battle. The next film I'm going to review is Totally Killer. When the infamous Sweet 16 killer returns 35 years after his first murder spree, whoa, dude, way to spoil it, to claim another victim, 17-year-old Jamie accidentally travels back in time to 1987, determined to stop the killer before he can start. This was released, did not get released in theaters, although I think it premiered at Fantastic Fest, whatever the fuck that is. But it released on Prime Video on October 6th. It's directed by God damn it, I'm so white. Nanachka Khan. She has also directed Always Be My Maybe. She created Young Rock, which was on NBC for a couple of seasons. I think it got canceled. That sucks. I mean, I did want to watch. I was like, I would like to watch that. But then other shows just caught my attention more. Fresh Off the Boat on ABC. And then Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23. Yet again, another series where I was like, Kristen Ritter, you minx. Kristen Ritter. I don't know what it is about her. It was written by David Madelon, Sasha Pearl Raver, what a name, and Jen D'Angelo. Of those three, the only credits I recognize are from Jen D'Angelo, who wrote Quiz Lady, which is that new movie with Awkwafina. I think Will Ferrell might be in it for a little bit. She also wrote Hocus Pocus 2, and episodes of Workaholics, Hell Yeah, and Cougar Town, which had a nice little run on TBS. Maybe. It stars Kiernan Shipka as Jamie Hughes. You might remember Kiernan Kiernan from Mad Men. She was like the little daughter, Dawn and Betty's daughter, Little Draper. What was her name? Don't remember. Elizabeth? I don't know. And then I think she was also in the reboot, the remake of Sabrina, the Teenage Witch on Netflix, I want to say. There's a lot of cast members, so I'm not going to go through them all. I'm only going to call out the ones that I recognize their credits. So a lot of the youngins, I don't know shit. Julie Bowen plays the adult Pam Hughes, Jamie's mom. Julie Bowen of Modern Family. Never watched it, but it's like apparently one of the top sitcoms of all time. And Happy Gilmore, where she had the best scene, one of the best scenes in any movie ever. Lingerie, two beer pitchers. So awesome. Lachlan Monroe, which that name probably doesn't pop out at you, but he played the adult Blake Hughes, or Jamie's dad. This dude has 270 credits. What are the four he's known for? Great question. Freddy vs. Jason, White Chicks. I think he was one of the agents. Scary Movie as Greg, which now that I think about it, I know exactly who that is. And then Night at the Roxbury. I believe he was their personal trainer. Will Ferrell and Chris Kattan's characters. Doug? Were they both named Doug? Their personal trainer, who Molly Shannon ends up falling for or dating throughout the movie. Kimberly Hui is an adult Lauren Creston. Her credits include Grey's Anatomy and The Blacklist. I have not watched either of those. Kelsey Mawama is Amelia Creston. So that was the Lauren's daughter. She was in the To All the Boys trilogy. For my target audience, my target demo, I mean, guys, remember the To All the Boys trilogy? Oh, my God. Steffi Chinsalvo is Marissa Song. She has appeared in Upload on Prime Video, which I highly recommend. Season 2 just came out. Anna Diaz as Heather Hernandez from Riverdale. And then Jonathan Potts as the adult Chris Dubasage, who is in The Strain. And honestly, honest to God, other than Kiernan Shipka, Julie Bowen, and Lachlan Monroe, Randall Park as Sheriff Dennis Lim from Fresh Off the Boat, WandaVision, Ant-Man, right? He plays the agent in WandaVision and Ant-Man. And then Always Be My Maybe, one of the best rom-coms of the 2020s? No, 2010s. I think it's 2010s. So I won't break down the whole plot because that's fucking bananas, but I will go over some cool quotes. Jamie, so mini recap of the plot. It's October 2023. There is a host of a podcast who does tours around town about these three murders that were committed in 1987. The Sweet 16 killer killed these three ladies, stabbing each of them 16 times. So that's why, and they were all 16 years old. I think it was all on their 16th birthdays. And so he was called the Sweet 16 killer. So the host of this true crime podcast, quote unquote, is giving a tour, and everyone in the tour is wearing the mask that the killer wore when he did these stabbings. So the Jamie, the daughter, this was kind of, I don't hate this, but she just casually goes to her friend and is like, hey, what are you up to? And her friend's like, yeah, I'm building a time machine. She's like, oh, cool. Is it working? No, it doesn't work yet. And it's just like, well, we're just going to casually talk about your friend creating a fucking time machine. But I think we're at that point now where it's like, there have been so many time travel movies and it's like, eventually you're going to have somebody with the balls and the know-how to try and create one, right? It's got to happen at some point. So I thought that was interesting. It was just like, yeah, building the time machine. Oh, how's the time machine coming along? It's coming along. So yeah, friend creates a time machine, but doesn't work, missing something, right? And so I guess it was Halloween night. Kiernan, the daughter, Jamie, goes to a concert, and the father has to drop her off because she can't drive yet. She's 16. And so drops her off, and the mother is like, your father is going to stay there until you're done. He's going to wait for you. And the father's like, oh, great, I'm going to wait. Sweet. So the mother is home alone, right? And that's when, there's a ring, the doorbell rings. She goes to the door, And she opens it, and there's a person dressed as the Sweet 16 killer. Now, everyone in that podcast tour of the town was wearing the same mask, right? So this is a mask that is sold, which is just outrageous that in real life, you know, a serial killer would actually, yeah, but who am I? So this person's wearing the same mask as the Sweet 16 killer, and she's like, oh my God, that's not funny. You shouldn't joke about that. Like, I hate that mask. And so that's when the person pulls out a knife and it's like, oh, fuck. This is the Sweet 16 killer. And so Julie Bowen, having experienced this in 1987, her character, Jamie's mom, like having gone through that, having seen her three best friends get murdered, has now prepared her. And she says this, I've prepared my entire life for this moment. Like, I've prepared myself for this. So, you know, a lot of self-defense, martial arts, which I thought was they set that up perfectly, and then was like, yep, this all tracks. But ends up getting stabbed to death. So this is an R-rated film. And you know, it kind of has a similar vibe to like Mean Girls-ish in terms of comedy, right? But it is R-rated. And I don't think because it is a comedy, but it's also horror. Like, I guess it feels not out of place, but unexpected. Like, I just totally forgot it was R. I guess the R will mostly be like profanity, maybe a little nudity. But like, no, they full on show people getting stabbed 16 times. And it's, you know, it's the ultimate question. Would you rather be shot or stabbed? I think I'll be shot. The stabbing freaks me out. We'll get to that in a little bit. How much it freaks me out. So I'm just going straight to quotes, and maybe I'll just explain stuff in between the quotes. So in this scene, I think it's where, so all signs are kind of pointing to this kind of recluse, right? This kid who everyone has meanly nicknamed Lurch. I don't think that's his actual name, but he's kind of isolated. At one point, Jamie is in class with him. It has to be his partner for some class, science class maybe. And she looks in his notebook and sees a lot of like, you know, violent, explicit drawings. And, you know, the handwriting kind of matches the note that was found at the crime scene where her mom was stabbed in the future in 2023. But so how does she get to 87? Huh. Yeah. Okay. So she comes home, discovers the mom, and then that's when the Sweet 16 killer tries to kill her. She goes on the run. By the way, Kiernan Shipka running. I don't know if this was intentional. Very funny. It looked a little off. I couldn't tell if she was doing it like on purpose for comedic effect, but it just didn't look right. So she runs away from the killer. She runs to Billy's Boardwalk, which is this amusement park. And that's where she climbs in the time machine. She can't get to work. She's pressing all the buttons. And all of a sudden, the killer takes a swipe with the knife. The knife goes into the main dashboard control, you know, the controls. And boom, that's when she's transported to 1987. And so she ultimately tries to prevent the murders and is unsuccessful. And preventing those murders, spoiler alert. But the whole point is to save her mom without completely fucking up the timeline, right? Because that's still a thing. Like, you do things in the past, you time travel the past, you change things don't change in the future, right? So the hope is that she'll prevent the Sweet 16 killer, but as like a plot B subplot, she finds out, like, because I should have just gone over the whole plot. Why did I say I'm not going to go over the plot when I'm going over the plot? What the fuck? So in one of the opening scenes, she's talking to her mom before going to the concert. And the mom's, I don't know how they got to this point, but they're like, she's talking to her dad. And she's like, you know, your mom and I went to high school together, but we didn't date when we were in high school. We weren't even friends. We didn't even talk to each other. It wasn't until I came home from college or when I was in college that we got together. And so she has that in the back of her mind as she's going through 1987. And she's seeing that her dad might have lied, because the mom is like got the hots for the dad big time. And so if they get together quickly, She figures, oh no, that's going to mean they don't get together at all, because that's not how things are supposed to shake out, right? They're supposed to like not talk in high school and get together after college or in college, and they don't have her for another. This is where the math really threw me off. I was like, wait, so if it's 2023 and she's 16, subtract 16 from 2003, that's 2007, dude? That can't be right.
What?
This girl was born in 2007. The fuck? Which is legitimately 20 years after 1987, which means that these two, the mother and the father, had her at 36, which, hey, listen, I had my kid when I was 37, almost 38. So I'm on the later side, you know, the average, especially outside the New York metropolitan area, lower for sure. So you're going to tell me that these two kids, I now have met two different guys. I talked about this on the pod last week that went to high school with their wives, but never talked to their wives in high school. They got together after high school, in college or after college. So in both cases, like they got, like the one friend got married in 09. I'm going to go on a limb and say this other dad, who probably graduated college in 2008, was at high school. Sweet baby Jesus. I think he graduated high school in 08, which means he graduated college in 2012, and they have at least a six-year-old. Do you smell what the rock is cooking, essentially? So I don't know. That was a little like, what's that? I don't buy that. And of course they end up getting all horned up, and it's like, so she's constantly trying to like make room for Jesus, you know, she's constantly trying to like separate them. She's like, this is not supposed to go down. And I'm afraid if you guys get together now, you won't get together later and you won't have me. So the first girl is murdered at her sweet 16 birthday party at her house. Her parents are not home. And originally she got murdered in the garage. Due to Jamie's actions, she's able to alter that slightly. But then, so this girl is with this musician named Eddie, who in the 2023 was the lead singer of Killer Instinct, who Jamie loves. She loves her music. And Jamie's mom is Pam, is like, oh yeah, I went to high school with that guy. He was kind of a jerk or whatever. And Jamie's like, no, he's great. He does all these things, like blah, blah. So this the first girl is about to hook up with Eddie, the musician, in her parents' bedroom, which has a waterbed. Sweet. Awesome. And the girl's like, oh, I'm going to get, she's like, he thinks he's going to blow him, or is like, are you going to blow me? And she's like, no, I don't do blowjobs. And then just walks to the bathroom and is like, I'm going to get ready for sex. So she goes in the bathroom, comes out. Eddie has left, or you think he's left, or maybe he hasn't. Wink, 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 wink. And the closet door is slightly ajar. And so she thinks Eddie's in the closet. And that's when the sweet 16 killer comes out with the mask, stabs her to death on the waterbed. So she ends up dying, right? But not in the same way. So Jamie has slightly altered it already. And then you can see they kind of time jump back and forth from 2023 to 1987. In 2023, you see like subtle changes. Like the host of the podcast, Chris Dubasage, is with Amelia, who created the time machine. And they, it's like a very, I think they handled the logistics of the time travel fairly well. They like didn't spend too much time explaining it. Just, you know, what, 3-5 rules, maybe 5-7 tops. Just like three little explanations of like what will happen, how the, you know, how this works and whatnot. She's like, is it like Back to the Future? They make a lot of references to Back to the Future. So she's like, is it like Back to the Future? Where like, if my parents, like, do I disappear? And the girl's like, I think it's the mom at that point in 87. But anyway, she's like, no, you won't disappear. Like, you'll just be stuck in this timeline and you'll just grow old. Like, you're going to grow old. You're not going to be 16 in 2023. When 2023 rolls around, 35 years from now, you're going to be 51 years old. So, like, you just exist now. I thought that was a really cool explanation. Not a thorough explanation or comprehensive, but it's like, all right, I can buy that. Sure. So anyway, the first girl, there's a quote. Jamie ultimately suspects she's like, I don't think it's Eddie. I don't think Eddie killed her, the first girl. Like, I just don't think it's him. I really don't. And ultimately, she ends up thinking it's this Lurch character who has all the scribblings and the notebook and is looking kind of shady and sus and conspicuous and whatnot. And so she ends up trying to, like, look through his van. So she breaks into the van and she's like, oh, it smells bad in here. And there's a blanket. And you think, oh, no, there's a she's like, there better not be a body under there. She picks it up and it's all video games. And then Lurch kind of surprises her, scares her a little bit, not intentionally. He's like, hey, what are you doing? And then she asks him, and because you find out that, spoiler, there was a girl named, they nicknamed Fat Trish, right? And these three girls that Pam is friends with that ultimately get murdered are kind of like the mean girls, right? They are the plastics, or they are the, they call themselves the Mollies after Molly Ringwald. Even though I don't think Molly Ringwald was a mean bitch, you know what I'm saying? But, she finds out that Lurch is the brother of Fat Trish, and Fat Trish died because the Mollies and Jamie's mom, who's part of the Mollies, got her drunk and wanted her to because they wanted her to spill the beans on someone or something. So they forced her to drink. Then Fat Trish got upset and left and drove home. And Jamie was like, why didn't you stop her? You know, because she ultimately crashes the car and dies. She gets it's a fatal car accident. And Lurch is her brother. It's Fat Trish's brother. So you find that out. And so, you know, that's for her, that's the motive, right? It's like, okay, your sister dies in a car accident because these people mistreated her, abused her. And so now you're going to get your revenge. And so it turns out, no, Lurch didn't do it. And he's like, Eddie didn't do it either. And so Jamie says, I know it wasn't Eddie, but how did you know it wasn't Eddie? And then Lurch says, he told me all about that night, how he was making out with Tiffany, but then left as soon as she said she didn't do blowjobs. Just think, maybe if she did do blowjobs, she'd still be alive. To which Jamie says, yeah, that's not, let's not make that the lesson. I love Randall Park in this movie. I thought he was one of the best performances. Like when she brings in the Ziploc, the paper towel. So she basically took a tissue, I think, or napkin, and was able to dab it in the killer's blood because she hit the killer. The killer was bleeding. She dabbed the napkin in the blood and then put it in a Ziploc bag and was like trying to hand it over to the cops. I'm like, here, I had like, here. You should be able to find him now. And they're like, what are we supposed to do with this napkin? She's like, it's covered in his blood. And they're like, yeah. So she's like, DNA. And they're like, DNA? What is that? It's just like, you forget. DNA was not like a thing before 1987. It was just like, what the fuck are you talking about? There was a great joke or bit about that. I think it might have been, I want to say it was Louis C.K., but it might have been John Mulaney. Or I think it was John Mulaney. You got to look it up. It was like Murder Scene or something like that in the 30s, where it's like in the 30s, 40s, 50s, they're like, they come up on a crime scene, there's blood everywhere. And like, Chief, come look at this. It's the killer's blood. And he was like, well, mop it up. Someone's going to fall on it. Like the DNA was just not a thing. So I thought that was funny when she's like, when he's like, oh yeah, I guess we'll just plug this into the DMA database. And she's, and they're like, what's DNA? And she's just like, it's the, what we're makes us, like it's in us. Like it's, and she couldn't explain it. I love that too. So Randall Park, obviously Cher, Dennis Lim, he goes old people, sick people, and people with dogs. And I guess partner Brody says, that's the order you hate people in. He goes, yep. And this part goes, that's a good order. there was a scene where it's so funny. Anytime Jamie goes to get information from someone that is in modern times, like you're going to have to jump through a lot of hoops. There's a lot of verification that goes on. There's a lot of due diligence. Like people are just not going to let things slide. They're not going to make it easy for you. Right. So she's expecting that in 1987. Like, she's like, hi, my name is Jamie LaFleur. I'm from Canada and I need to enroll in the school. And the woman goes, okay, here's your schedule. Like, is this? And she goes, what? Like, you don't want to see, that's it? And so as she's leaving, she goes, oh my God, flying on a plane right now must be insane. It's like, yeah, it was pretty insane. People smoked on the plane and were able to bring like guns, knives, the whole nine. There was a quote that I really wish they didn't have in the movie, because I really did think it kind of ruined it and spoiled it. It was, I forget at what point in the movie, but Jamie says there might be two killers like in Scream. I think it was back in 87 when she first gets there. She's like, I think there might be two killers like in Scream. And the girl's like, what are you talking about? Because she goes to the cops and she's like, haven't you ever seen Back to the Future? Like, it's out now. It's been out. It's like one of the most popular movies. And the cops are like, nah, I don't like time travel movies. You know, they never make any sense, which I thought was funny. And she's like, oh, because she's trying to prevent the murder. So she's going to the cops and saying, this murder's going to happen here. This murder's going to happen here. And they're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Run along. Aren't you supposed to be at school? And so then when she says to Amelia, have you ever seen Back to the Future? She's like, yeah, duh, of course. And she says, Jamie says there might be two killers like in Scream. And Amelia's like, what are you talking about? Because Scream came out in 96. If I understand, it's like it's too spot on of a setup. It's not subtle in any way. And so as soon as she says that, I go, it's probably two killers. So that was one major line that they could have done without. Like, I understand she's positing things and she's probably taking that into consideration, but I wish maybe not say it. I don't know. As far as trivia goes, Jamie mentions the movie Back to the Future several times, as I've mentioned several times. It includes, so in Back to the Future, Marty tries to get his future parents together, while in this movie, Jamie tries to keep her future parents apart. Also, like Marty, Jamie needs the help of the younger version of the genius who built the time machine to help her fix it and get her back to the future. So, although it's a mom in the past, it's not the daughter. So it's like, that's not the same genius, but it is a younger version of, yeah. You know what I'm saying. Jamie, Pam, and Blake have the last name Hughes. This is a nod towards director John Hughes, who directed the movie Breakfast Club, which starred Molly Ringwald, Pam's favorite actress. I picked up on that right away. Not to brag, but I was like, oh, yeah, Hughes, I see what you're doing. And I like it. Jamie, the lead character, is named after Jamie Lee Curtis. How am I supposed to know that? Now, if she went around, she's like, my name is Jamie Lee. It's like, okay. Her name is Jamie. Like, that seems like a stretch. The killer wears a mask depicting the face of a grinning blonde-haired man designed by makeup wizard Tony Gardner. Director Nanachka Khan explains that the mask, quote, had to originate in the 80s, so you have to have that nostalgic vibe. But in our movie, people still dress up like the killer in present day, so I wanted it to feel a little bit relevant. We landed on the idea of a handsome man being terrifying. Our makeup wizard and design team started pulling 80s heartthrob references like Kiefer Sutherland, Rob Lowe, Dolph Lundgren, and even Johnny Bravo. Johnny Bravo? Distant cousin of Johnny Bravo. And then exaggerated and made the teeth oversized. I definitely picked up on Johnny Bravo, for sure, with that, how cartoonish it was. I can definitely now see a little bit of Dolph Lundgren in there. Kiefer Sutherland, not so much. Rob Lowe, yeah, that jaw, my guy. This was kind of crazy. It was criticized for being identical, quote unquote, to the Final Girls, which came out in 2015. But they had, like, it's, I guess, the same idea. Daughter goes back in time to save mom, but they had completely different plots. Like, the Jamie in Totally Killer uses a time machine to go back in time to stop her mom's murderer. The Final Girls is about a group of friends who get sucked into a 1980s horror film starring one of their mothers. So, I just talked about last time about three movies about murderous, psychotic animatronics come to life. Willy's Wonderland, Banana Splits, and, well, not Banana Splits maybe so much. Willy's Wonderland and Five Nights at Freddy's. Like, I don't know. It's stand-up comedy, too. There's a lot of parallel thinking. So, I'm not... I'm not going to like, what's the word? Indemnify? Condemn this movie for being too similar. I literally, I watched this movie. I didn't one time think, oh, this is like Final Girls. There's too many differences. It's like, I mean, you could say, like, if that's the case, you can say the Final Girls is the same as insert time travel movie where parent tries to save, a child tries to save parent. Come on now. Teen Pam, that's Jamie's mom, and her snobby friends dress up as various characters that actress Molly Ringwald portrayed, and they call themselves the Mollies, as I mentioned. This is a nod to the film Heathers, which came out in 1988. And then I don't know if this trivia is right. The victims and promo poster bear a haunting resemblance to the victims of the real-life Moscow, Idaho massacre in November of 2022, which this, I don't think that episode ever went out, but I was there, not there, very close to there. I shouldn't criminalize. Was that word? I shouldn't minimize myself. You know what I'm getting at. But I was in Pullman, Washington, which is like near the border of Idaho, which is near Moscow, Idaho, that same weekend that it happened. I'm still trying to find out how to get that episode out. It was a lot of technical difficulties. But furthermore, the house number of the main protagonist family in this film, the Hughes, is 1122. Same number as the house in Idaho, Moscow, Idaho, 1122 Kings Road. That is someone who's got a lot of time on their hands. So much like the podcast host, the true crime host of the true crime podcast. So yeah, that's quite the coincidence. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I they are entertaining. Holy shit. Goofs. There are a lot of goofs in this movie, and I think that's what turned a lot of people off. They're not major goofs. I don't know. I didn't even catch a lot of the shit that I'm about to read to you, but the biggest one I think that really holds true, and it might have really brought down the ratings from critics and fans alike, what that I didn't even freaking pick up on because I'm dumb. If Jamie travels back in time, it's in 87, that means there's a different 2023 now. This person is saying, who submitted the goof, is saying there would actually be two Jamies at the end of the film in the final timeline, because original Jamie travels back to 2023 in the altered timeline, but the Jamie from altered timeline never went back in time, so she would still exist. And they established that one of the rules of this version of time travel, people don't disappear because of changes. So I think that makes sense. If alternate 2023 Jamie existed, but wait. Yes, because she hands it. So yeah, because when she goes to the new 2023 that she created where her mom is alive, you then have the this older gentleman walk up. And I don't know why I thought this, but I thought it was Lurch all grown up. Like he was going to. Meanwhile, they had already shown the adult Lurch at Billy's Boardwalk Amusement Park. Durr. So I thought it was like Lurch. Instead, it is the kid, their first kid, the Hughes. Pam and is it Jim? No, it's not Jim. It can't be. No, it's not Jim. It's Brandon, I think. So the parents end up getting together anyway, right? Because the end of the film, it's basically spoiler. The host of the True Crime podcast is the second killer. He traveled back. He realized that things were being changed, and he realized that he was not going to hit superstardom, because if Jamie prevents the murders, that means that he never gets to host the podcast that is somewhat successful, right? It's like his cash cow. Right. That's how he that's his lifeline. That's how he makes his due. So if the murders go away, the podcast goes away. Right. Because he knows that's as lucrative, and that's how he's getting the recognition he is getting. But he also has a father that he lives in his father's shadow, because his father started off local news anchor, but then a reporter, and then moved his way up to, I think, a regional national. And so he's like a big name, very successful. And so he's living in his father's shadow. And So he goes back in time to 1987, and after they kill the first killer, the original killer, who happens to be who that was, I gotta say, it feels a little far-fetched. What was, I honestly forget now, because they, I think they do reveal why, what his motive was at the end when they end up tricking him and trapping him and then eventually killing him. Not before he kills the third girl, which was, you know, it was kind of funny when she's like, I'm going to give you this rape whistle and you're going to blow this rape whistle if you're in danger, and we'll hear it and we'll come get you, or, you know, you'll scare him off. And she's like, but what if he gets to me first? And I think even the one of the other kids asked the same thing, like, well, like, is she going to be able to blow the rape whistle when he's attacking her? And like, and so sure enough, like, he comes up from behind and like slices her throat, and then she blows the whistle. It's like, oh god, so morbidly black comedy, dark black comedy, black comedy, dark comedy. Still get a kick out of it. So yeah, I guess there would be two Jamies. But yeah, so the parents still get together. After, so the killer, they're in the Gravitron type thing where the time machine is that is working. And so the killer throws the mother, Jamie's mom, out of the Gravitron, which, I mean, you could die, right, from that. And I think he was pretty confident that he killed her again. And yeah, so he wants to kill her and the other three because he wants this podcast to keep on keeping on. And so he was the one, ultimately, in the original 2023, the original timeline, who ended up killing Pam, Jamie's mom, in the year 2023, because he needed the podcast to keep going, because I guess it was losing steam, maybe. So I guess the parents still get together, but it's earlier than college or after college, and they have that first kid, and the first kid is a son. And so it was funny because she's like, who is that hot guy? And it's like, well, that is your older brother. So yeah, who would be 34 or 36? Yeah, it would be 34, right? In that range. Cause like it was 35 years ago, all the murders happened, and they were these two crazy kids were just all over each other. So there's no way they would have practiced safe sex, and they would have had at it. Senior year in high school or junior year in high school, like their year, and then had the older brother that next year. So she has the older brother, but it's still interesting that like they have the older brother, but then wait, like if they have the older brother in 88, 89, he'd be 34. Then they're going to wait 18 years to have their second kid. 89, 07, 18 years. There's an 18-year difference between those two friggin' kids. That was kind of hard to buy. But yeah, so Amelia's mom, who had to live through all that, kept a notebook, which I thought was cool. She kept the notes, and she's like, yep, so here are all the changes. Here's to get you up to speed. But for a lot of people, it's like, but wait a minute. Wouldn't there be a Jamie that... So it's like... And I think that was what was interesting. Well, maybe they didn't cover it in the notebook. Oh, so... See, this is where I think this person's wrong, that there are two Jamies at the end of the film, or there should be two Jamies, because Jamie didn't exist in that altered timeline. Well, she did in 87, but then she time traveled to 23. So she didn't exist from 88 to 2022, right? No. No, yeah. So from 2008 to 2022, no, sorry. Fuck, dude. From 87 to 23. For 35 years, she didn't exist. For 34 years, she didn't exist. And so that's why they named... She had such a profound effect on the parents that they named their firstborn Jamie for her, because she disappeared. They don't know what happened. And then... So her name in the altered timeline is Colette. But you can kind of see where I'm getting at here, right? I think she did exist in 87, so they know she exists. And I think eventually the mother is spilling the beans and is like, hey, She's actually not a psychic. She was your daughter from 2023 coming back to try and save you. And she's going back to 2023. But here's the kicker. You will miss 16 years of her life. Is that possible? I don't know. I have a headache. And there's like minor stuff that I don't know that needs to be said. So Metacritic gave it a 62 out of 100. And I'm going to look up Rotten Tomatoes. I didn't even fucking do that. That is pathetic. Let's see here. Come on now. Come on now. 87% of all critics gave it a favorable review with a 6.5 out of 10. And then 77% of top critics gave it a favorable review with a 6.2 out of 10. I think I gave this a 6 out of 10, but I could be talked into a 7. 76% of the audience on Rotten Tomatoes gave it a favorable review with a 3.95 out of 5 average rating. I'm not going to go that high. I'll do a 3 out of 5. But for it to be a positive review, it had to be 3.5 out of 5. I guess, yeah. I guess, I mean, I didn't hate it. Like, I didn't love it, but it's so close to being a 7 out of 10 for me that I almost should do a 7 out of 10, but I gave it a 6. I'm thinking about it. I think it's like a high 6. Sort of like no hard feelings, like a high 6 that's lower than 6.5. So like a 6.4. So that would be like a, more than 3.5 out of 5. So recommend. You're not going to regret it. Critics' consensus was Totally Killer may not take full advantage of its promising conceit. This time-traveling horror sci-fi mashup is still enjoyable overall. The audience on Rotten Tomatoes says, Totally Killer has fun with its premise and Kieran and Shipka is great in the lead. So even if this isn't the best movie of its kind, it's still worth a watch. Yeah, I mean, are there better time-travel movies? Sure. They're better horror movies? Sure. The better sci-fi movies? Sure. But the fact that they were able to mash all that shit up and they pulled off fairly well. So with some nitpicky things here and there about, you know, this didn't exist. Game Boy didn't exist. Gravity Drops didn't exist. RoboCop didn't exist. It's like, it's not that egregious. You'd have to be a real nerd to pick up on that. So, yeah, it's Totally Killer.